This is oral history interview number 14. Dr. John A. Pierce, professor of the Department of Medicine at the Washington University School of Medicine, talks about the life and scientific work of Dr. Alfred Goldman. We are talking today with Dr. Pierce about the life and times of Dr. Goldman. Dr. Pierce?
Dr. Goldman was proud of the fact that five boys in his family were encouraged greatly by their father to achieve in scholarly pursuits, and four of the boys actually won scholarships to Washington University. Dr. Goldman was one of the ones that did attend Washington University on a scholarship, and he really didn't. This attitude was reflected in his own accomplishments in school, as he was elected to Phi Beta Kappa and AOA as a result of his outstanding scholarship. So I think it's not unusual to have expected, even from his early beginnings, that he might have gone farther than most people in his profession, and that he was indeed an exceptional person. And perhaps it was one aspect of this that led him to get interested in investigative work as a medical student, which was really quite unusual for that particular time, but which was done under the warm but firm hand of Professor Joe Erlang, who was then chairman of the Department of Physiology.
That's interesting. I didn't realize there was a connection there. We have the Dr. Erlanger's papers in the archives, so
yes,
you see how they mesh together.
Dr. Goldman often spoke about Dr. Erlanger in very warm and friendly phrases, and actually it was with two classmates of his, Stuart Mudd and Sam Grant, that he began to work on the cold experiment, and it was in, as they called Dr. Erlanger affectionately, Uncle Joe's icebox, that the fellows took off their clothes and exposed themselves to temperatures around 40 degrees centigrade or so to complete their investigation. The topic that was then of such great interest was what promotes or produces upper respiratory tract infections, and what influence does cold exposure have on these things, and actually this is a topic of some current interest today even yet, but at those times, before there was any capability in the virus field at all, attention was naturally focused on the bacteria. And so what doctors Mudd and Goldman and Grant did, which produced a series of papers that have been quoted for many years in the literature, was that they did expose themselves to cold, and they took cultures of their throats before and after and during the exposure, and they did document the fact that each one of them had a somewhat of a tendency to recover organisms of a specific type following the cold exposure. The most commonly cited finding of theirs was the measurements they did on the temperature in the throat with and following the cold exposure, and their demonstration that this did in fact produce an intense vasoconstriction in the nasal and upper nasopharyngeal mucosa, and it was their thought that this promoted or permitted the multiplication of bacteria and a relatively more easy invasion of the respiratory tract with organisms. That was the principal subject of the first several papers that Dr. Goldman actually published. But it was an outgrowth of this that really led to Dr. Goldman's own important discovery of, and description of the physiology of hyperventilation. What actually happened was that Dr. Grant and Dr. Goldman noticed, as they were measuring a number of things through their cold exposure experiments, actually noticed that their urine had an alkaline pH every time following cold exposure. And they reasoned appropriately that this was due to hyperventilation. And one way it was expressed was that they would find themselves over-breathing without really trying or intending to. And this captured their attention because there were some previous experiments or descriptions of altered physiology in hyperventilation, but there was no clear-cut recognition that one could overbreathe to the point of producing tetany. And it was this particular finding that Goldman and Grant worked out in very careful detail, in meticulous detail. And I think that there's evidence of Dr. Erlanger's hand in the thing too, because
that's interesting.
It's carefully documented with respect to the earlier literature, and in effect, it's first quality, it's top quality research. For that time, and it was meticulously done, and undoubtedly played a big part in the professional development of the men that did the experiment. Dr. Goldman was even cited in a book by the eminent Professor Haldane, who has been called the father of respiratory physiology. Because on several occasions during the course of hyperventilation experiments, Dr. Goldman did produce in himself generalized tetany. And the way Dr. Haldane expressed it was that poor Goldman even was so vigorous in his investigation that he knocked himself out with the overbreathing. Actually, once they realized they wanted to study hyperventilation, what was done was they set up a metronome and actually intentionally overbreathed by the count, as you would play a drum or play a piano.
So this was done very scientifically.
Oh yeah, and they sustained this for a fairly lengthy period, so that the end result, and sometimes after 15 minutes or after 20 minutes, was on a few occasions tetany. Most of the time they didn't reach the tetany point, but they did measure the serial changes in pH, and they did demonstrate for the first time that it was the marked reduction in carbon dioxide from the lungs that led to the marked alkalosis, and they inferred in their discussion that it was likely that ionized calcium had a role in this thing. And of course this has been the subsequent story, that as it became possible to measure ionized calcium, the alkalosis decreases the amount of ionized calcium to the point that tetany is produced.
They did some study of mass hyperventilation too, didn't they?
I'm sorry?
Of mass hyperventilation?
Well,
I thought I noticed in Dr. Goldman's description of his work that it hadn't been recognized that such a thing could exist up to that point.
Yes, I don't know. I don't remember an experiment that went with that, but I think that it was common experience in the years following there with description, as medical school experiments were designed for people in the classes of physiology, which required sustained hyperventilation. It was common experience to run on to one or two medical students per class that had a kind of a runaway hyperventilation, and it couldn't be stopped after the class was over. They couldn't just simply stop overbreathing and go back to the normal state. And of course, this is the kind of overventilation that was really Dr. Goldman's largest scientific contribution. This is the instance of hysterical hyperventilation that he recognized in the emergency room, and he probably would not have been so quick to recognize it if he hadn't personally participated in the self-experiments that made him intimately familiar with all the details of hyperventilation. And I believe it is accurate that his was the first clinical description of what's now called the hyperventilation syndrome, which is more or less hysterical overbreathing. He also talks in his papers about the hyperventilation following muscular exercise. And of course, there's always been intense interest amongst physiologists, in fact, still today, trying to sort out the various contributory factors to the hyperventilation of exercise. And this is a subject that was of interest to Dr. Thorne. I think that he recognized the kind of treatment that was indicated, namely reversing the process by rebreathing, and no one has really improved on this sort of an immediate solution to the clinical problem, so that it's still rebreathing that's done today. And I think that Dr. Goldman also recognized when the problem was at an end, and so I think he reasoned his way through this, and he saw it. He didn't like at later periods of time when he didn't work additionally.
Yes, that's interesting.
Drop it when the time was right to drop it, I think.
That's very true. He didn't. He went on to other things, other interests.
One of the ones that he went on to that was much interesting, to me anyway, was the early cytology study. And he did present one of the earliest papers, not the first, but one of the earliest papers to detect the presence of malignant cells in pleural fluid. And he wrote two papers at the widely spaced interval, maybe 10 or 15 years apart, illustrating that he had sustained an interest in this connection. And one was in the cytology of sputum in the later times, when that form of cancer diagnosis seemed reasonable, as the cells were better recognized. And the other was the malignant cells in the pleural fluid. But I think that he has to be given credit for certainly stimulating local interest in the cytologic diagnosis of cancer, because he published his earliest paper, I think, around 1929 on that particular subject. His work was always close to the patient from the early days on, and after he finished the experiments that he did, for which he received a master's degree in physiology, practically all of his investigations stemmed from problems that he was confronted by through his patients.
Well, after his master's degree, then he had a full patient load of clinical work, didn't he? And he was doing he was doing this also, in addition to his full-time responsibilities.
That's right.
His medical practice.
That's right. I've heard him talk a number of times about his interest in lung disease and the fact that he was very interested in tuberculosis. And like myself, with this same interest, he was one of the relatively few people at that time that did not have tuberculosis. And he had not had tuberculosis himself, and so many of the earlier chest physicians had developed their interest in chest diseases and lung diseases by a personal experience with tuberculosis. Dr. Goldman had not had tuberculosis himself. In fact, I've heard him say a number of times at the early meetings of the College of Chest Physicians and the American Thoracic Society, and he was one of the very few people around that didn't have some form of clinical experience personally with tuberculosis. I don't know how he happened to take such a sustained interest in lung diseases. Perhaps it was the contact with the hyperventilation. But I believe of the three classmates who worked on the problem in the cold, he was the only one that stayed professionally in academic thoracic medicine throughout his professional life. He took a great interest in, and I think it's purely and simply related to his strong attachment to his patients and his genuine and deep interest in the problems that they had. He took a great interest in industrial diseases and occupational exposures, and served as a consultant for a number of companies locally, and was always intent on making as accurate and impartial a judgment as he could about what the situations really were.
Well, he seems to have a real skill in delineating new diseases, recognizing a set of symptoms as being different than, different from other symptoms, and in writing papers on it, recognizing this.
Yeah, this is attributable to his extremely careful scholarship,
mm-hmm.
and his tenacity to stay after a problem,
yes.
Until he really had wrestled it down, mm-hmm. to his own satisfaction. He was fairly demanding of himself. And so when he saw something that was different, he stayed with it.
That's true.
So he saw it all the way through to the end.
Because it would take a great deal of work, not only recognizing it, but was studying it.
Being sure that you know what you're saying,
yes.
Really well.
Uh-huh.
This is the hard part.
Yes, that's true. Because he was busy with his patients, too,
well.
At the same time.
It's very easy to let time go by and to not put these things in the literature.
That's right.
It's important.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is much to his credit, and I think it really certifies and documents his academic capacity as very great indeed.
Was he ever tempted to go into full-time academic work in the fields he was interested in?
I think that he had taken on the clinical load in his private practice at such an early time that he never seriously considered dropping that at a later date. Although I really never did talk to him about that transition. He was, without question, deeply involved in the medical school, deeply committed to the medical school, and had such a great attachment to his students at all levels,
mm-hmm.
that I've had many of them in the last several years approach me in different meetings around the country and inquire about my development and express their appreciation and gratitude for his effort.
Well, how much contact would he have with students, or how did he meet them?
Well, he participated in the student teaching program in the Department of Medicine over an extremely long period of time. Mm-hmm. Dr. Moriton one time, Dr. Goldman was in his teaching
program. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
In the medical school. And of course, his period of time on the faculty, mm-hmm. was really 50 years.
Yes.
And since 1967, when I took over the directorship of the Pulmonary Disease Division, Dr. Goldman had attended conferences two or three times a week, almost without fail.
Well, that's interesting.
For the whole time, until after his illness forced him into retirement in July 1973. And so his exposure was really quite good, quite sustained,
mm-hmm.
and he was a frequent discusser at conference, and when ever questions arose about industrial diseases or the things that he had experienced with, he always spoke up. As a consultant in the hospital, he was often called on to evaluate clinical situations, and he always, in that situation, gave his information to the rest of the medical students, and so there was individual contact through that mechanism all through these last years, and I'm sure for the 50 years before,
mm-hmm.
so that his heart really was in medical school. I think from the time he entered private practice on, he never ceased to be a very strong participant in our clinical teaching program. He had a number of topics, in fact, x-rays and things that he gave me, and I know personally he gave other members of the field and some of the other things, that he was anxious to see some of the young people get interested in and work on,
mm-hmm.
So that he didn't figure all the problems were solved. He knew where the problems still were, and he was hoping that we could interest somebody in really doing some work. Mm-hmm.
So this extended over, really, from the time he graduated from medical school, he maintained his close connection with the school, and his interest in the students would certainly be shown by his participation, weekly participation.
That's right, and he has a very strong following from a large number of graduates of our school.
It's intriguing, too, that Carl V. Moore was a student, and then he knew him from that point on.
That's right.
Would you like to talk about his clinical work with patients? Of course, we have talked about this to some
extent. Yes, I would like to say this, and it's very typical and characteristic of the genuine nature of Dr. Goldman's interest in people. He approached all of the patients that I saw him with, and I saw in contact between him and the patient, with the same sort of attitude of respect and almost affection, and with the sincere interest in their problems and taking their problems as his problem. And it really didn't matter what the patient's background was, mm-hmm. or who he was, or sex or color he was. Dr. Goldman had the same deep, genuine interest in him. And his clinical judgment was uncanny and something of a conversation point around the school, because no matter how obscure or difficult the patient's problem might be, it was generally conceded that you couldn't trick or fool Dr. Al Goldman. And in my years with him, this has certainly been true. He did have a deep interest in tuberculosis and a lot of patients with tuberculosis. As he retired from practice and he took great pains and care to refer each patient to a colleague that he felt might be sort of characteristically suited for that patient's need. And of course I got it for several of his patients, and it almost continues today. Each time I see one of those patients, they have something additional to tell me or say about Dr. Goldman. They were all very concerned with his health before he passed away, and all inquiring about that. There was almost an unbelievable aura of love and affection that the patients had for them, not only as their physician, but as me, and they respected him. I think this has to emanate from the heart. One can't sort of think
that's
genuine, or you don't. Either you have it or you don't.
Yes.
Display it.
We already talked about his relationship with Carl V. Moore. Would you like to talk about some of the other of his colleagues?
Well, I had a sort of just chance occurrence of contact with some former professional colleagues and so forth. I might mention just two little stories that could be of interest. After Dr. Goldman was ill and knew that he had metastatic chondrosarcoma in his lung, the question sort of naturally arose whether cancer chemotherapy might be worthwhile. And the local experts are as good as any of them. We reaffirmed this in the course of the subsequent events. But Dr. Goldman asked whether I would look into this and see what I could find out about it, probably more as an interested friend than as a physician, but I went to the library and searched the literature and tried to see what I could find out about it, and came up with a list of five or six experts around the country that I thought were eminent in the cancer chemotherapy field, then consulted with two of the local experts that Dr. Goldman had been in touch with, and decided on sending letters off to the three of these people at different other major medical centers. It turned out that one of these went to the MD Anderson Foundation in Houston, which is now part of the University of Texas. And the director immediately referred it to his division chief that worked in this particular area of connective tissue tumors, who, lo and behold, turned out was a top tumor on the phone, was a former student of Dr. Goldman. Very much involved with Dr. Goldman. Sadly, to hear about his illness, and great and willing to see Dr. Goldman at any time that Dr. Goldman would like to come down. And as it worked out, we made the decision, and principally it was Dr. Goldman's decision, not to try that sort of therapy because of the toxic effects. Seemed to be overwhelming and the beneficial effects very questionable. And so Dr. Goldman didn't proceed down to see his former student and take the therapy. But I thought what a small world it was for a man to come all the way around the full circle and have a referral to one of his own former students, who in fact is quite an expert in this therapeutic field. The other story that I think of right now is that I was visiting another major medical center last week and had occasion to discuss with one of the other site visitors who's now at a state university in the East. Washington University, as it turns out, this young man was a graduate of our school.
I see.
And a classmate of Dr. Goldman's son. And they were quite close friends during medical school, and so Robert Wallman is the man that I was talking to, had some interesting stories, new to me clinical stories to tell him that Dr. Goldman is his teacher in medical school and he finished some 10 to 15 years ago. But this kind of thing continues to happen all along. And my point of telling the story about Dr. Wallman is simply to illustrate that there many hundreds of physicians around the country that have personal knowledge and experience with Dr. Goldman as a teacher, and he was indeed an expert and dedicated
When did you first come to know Dr. Goldman?
I first knew him in 1967, and I must say he was extremely helpful from the day I arrived in St. Louis, and he was anxious to support the program in any way that we really would call on him and have him, and he went well beyond the call of duty in his support. And in fact, I might mention that Dr. Goldman's family, on the occasion of his birthday the year before last, established a permanent book award so that the graduating senior who participates in the pulmonary disease teaching program as a senior student is awarded a rather handsome book allowance if he's chosen as the outstanding student that comes through the division for the year, and it's called the Alfred Goldman Book Award.
Well, that's very interesting. That shows
perpetual
memorial. Do you have any additional comments you would like to make about Dr. Goldman?
Well, I think that, except to say, I think that Dr. Goldman was the sort of totally dedicated man. He was intensely dedicated to his family, and during the last months of his life, I had a large number of discussions with him. He was proud of his parents and the family he was raised in. He did everything to promote the kind of atmosphere and environment that you want for your children, and he saw all three of his children graduate from college, and two of them from professional school. He always had a lot of fun living it, and always enjoyed a good story, and was an excellent storyteller. I remember on one occasion he mentioned to me that he had just about been everywhere, and he thought he'd just about done everything, and he had a lot of fun. And he didn't really think that he had his whole life to go through again, that he would change anything very drastically at all. He literally lived for his patients and his family. And after he passed away, I remember talking to Mrs. Gilbert in some detail about his scientific work and the papers that he published, and it was her comment that he did all of this without any conversation on the display at all, that he just quietly went about his work, and when it was time to print, he just printed it. He didn't say anything to her. He scarcely knew very much about it, but I think it illustrates that his mature direction of purpose and the way that he was able to channel his efforts to the appropriate channel at the appropriate time.
This RMSP interview with Dr. Pierce was conducted on April 3rd, 1974.